Could the web bring democracy to China? The answer to this question and more on this week's Radio Berkman. The phrase digital revolution may have a greater meaning in China than in most other parts of the world. With 20% of Chinese citizens now online, China's net population is larger than the population of the entire United States. And the conversations going on here in the free world about government transparency and voter participation, those debates are actually happening in China too. President Obama may be on YouTube, but Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao held an entire two-hour public web chat just last month. Could the digital revolution in China actually trigger a political revolution in the near future? Not so fast. China's institutions are still considered strongly authoritarian. Despite the sophisticated discourse on public affairs going on among China's web-enabled, and the sharing of super cute videos of kitties, Rebecca McKinnon is an Open Society Fellow, co-founder of Global Voices, and a professor and researcher at the University of Hong Kong's Journalism and Media Studies Center. She recently stopped by our studio to chat with David Weinberger about China, democracy, the web, and alpacas.
The internet in China, I think sometimes in the West people have this sense that because there's censorship in China, because it's an authoritarian state, people must not be having very much fun and must be kind of waiting to be freed. Whereas, in fact, there's a tremendous amount happening on the Chinese internet, and people are actually having a pretty lively, even political discourse to a certain extent. You know, the Chinese government has really lost control over culture in China. You can become a rock star, literally, in China. You can become a very popular novelist or poet just by posting things on the internet. And so this has really transformed youth culture in China. But at the same time, nobody has managed to emerge as an opposition politician on the web. Nobody's managed to organize an opposition party on the web. And this is because there's been enough control to prevent that.
When pop culture veers off into politics or into cultural taboos or anything close to that, how tightly controlled is that?
Well, you still get a lot of pretty interesting stuff. So, for instance, there's a guy named Hu Ge who routinely does YouTube spoofs of Chinese Central Television news. They're kind of Tina Fey-ish. They're very, very funny. He just kind of mimics the style of these anchors and the nature of the meetings. Anyway, very, very funny. And these spread around virally. So you do get a lot of commentary. You also get all kinds of, you know, even sillier things going on. For instance, there was a crackdown against porn that took place in China in January, where a lot of websites with smutty material got taken down. But that also ended up extending to political content. So a very popular blogging network that had politically edgy conversations on it also got taken down in the anti-smut campaign. And so in protest, some people created this viral video called The Ode to the Alpaca Sheep. Now, again, this is kind of bizarre, but the word for alpaca sheep, when you change the characters, sounds exactly like F your mother. And so it's this viral video with the cute alpaca sheep and a children's chorus singing about alpaca sheep, but they're actually, you know, singing F your mother, F your mother. And so that was one kind of very edgy protest video.
So very lively internet culture. Some political discussion, some open discussion, even on official Chinese government sites.
That's right. Yeah. So right now, the National People's Congress is going on. It's a two-week, you know, some would say rubber stamp legislative body that meets once a year. And for the first time this year, they created the e-Congress, where people can actually go on and post suggestions for policy change. And people are going on and doing that. And there's even some fairly edgy stuff, like somebody was suggesting that they do away with the one-child policy. And then there was a whole comment thread. They're allowing comments and people posting comments about, you know, pro and con. And this decision, this whole discussion is up there on a government media site. But at the same time, a independent blogger who wrote a critical blog post about both this and Premier Wen's web chat, saying that all of this is irrelevant and everybody's just getting all emotional and kind of getting won over by what is really kind of an empty ploy to placate us, and that until we have institutional change, this is all meaningless. He got censored, and his blog is now shut down. There's a scholar named Yongnian Zheng, who's recently written a book where he talks about what he calls authoritarian deliberation, and that within different authoritarian societies, you can actually have quite a bit of deliberation. And so there's some authoritarian countries like Burma or North Korea where you could say there's pretty much no deliberation happening amongst the public about public affairs. It's just not possible. All conversations of any meaning are shut down. In China, there's actually a very large amount of deliberation, of public discourse taking place about matters of public concern, about corruption, about economic policy, about what China should be doing with the U.S., you know, just all kinds of different conversations going on. And so China has become more deliberative, and there have actually been instances where conversations happening online have impacted certain specific policies and laws. Yet at the same time, institutionally, China hasn't become any more democratic. So actually, if you look at the legal system, it's not changed at all in 10 years. Back in the 90s, there was a serious attempt to institute free, fair, secret ballot-based village elections. And this was kind of spreading around the countryside. And there was actually a plan by some government officials in the Civil Affairs Ministry to take that voting up to the county level. And so actually you could argue that institutionally China was a little bit more democratic 10 years ago than it is today. Yet there's more public discourse today, and people feel like in terms of speech that they have more ways to speak out. Journalists feel a little more mixed in China actually in terms of like investigative reporting was probably actually easier to do 10 years ago than it is now. But the average citizen feels like there's so much more they can say and do online and be heard and potentially have an impact than they could 10 years ago. So there's a feeling of freedom.
So one of the common ways of thinking about this, of framing this, is that a change in culture, enabling a culture that has a greater sense of freedom builds a demand that eventually results in changes in the institutions. Is that what you see happening in China? Or are you saying, in fact, that the freedom to speak online is relieving the pressure to change institutions?
Well, you know, China is one of those places where, you know, different things that contradict one another all happen at the same time. So my answer to your entire question is yes. definitely, I think in the short term, I think the greater deliberation is relieving pressure for institutional change. That one could argue that the short to medium term, the Communist Party may stay in power longer thanks to the internet, because they're actually figuring out how to manage and participate in the conversation, I think, much more than many Westerners ever imagined they would do. And they also censor it in a more sophisticated way than anybody ever imagined either. So there's kind of both of those sides to it. In the longer term, of course, the internet changes everything. It has changed individuals in China. Like a non-trivial number of Chinese people fundamentally in terms of the way they view their relationship with society and their expectations and so on. And so longer term, this must have implications.
The people who are being changed are the ones who are online, which
yes.
tend in China as in elsewhere,
right.
tend to be more of the
Yeah, and
elite.
It's only 20% of the Chinese population at this point also. So, you know, I mean, there's a large number of Chinese people who are not online at all. So definitely as the government is talking about being more open and being more responsive to the public through the internet, it really means being responsive to the wired elites or the educated kind of more aware people. And there is a concern that that might make them even less responsive to people who are not online. Now, if you're looking at it from a pragmatic point of view, and if your goal is regime stability and preventing, you know, movements and leaders from emerging that would bring about a regime change, that's probably smart, because I think people who aren't using the internet are unlikely to get, you know, to really lead a national movement, most likely. However, you could also envision something coming out of complete left field because it was completely offline.
And under the radar, the new radar.
Completely under the radar. So, yeah, maybe this whole focus on the internet will make the government less capable of seeing what's coming at it from non-online communities. Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times columnist, a few years ago wrote an editorial that, you know, broadband will bring down the Chinese Communist Party, or is the Achilles heel of the Chinese Communist Party. And I think certainly in the short and medium term, that's not true. You could see, well, people kind of gradually are so changed that their expectations change so much that something happens, or that the critical mass, that there's a crisis, and then, you know, enough people who are online are pissed off enough that they're willing to take the risk, and then they do use the internet to bring about change. You could see that happening. Or you could see a situation where just kind of gradual evolution, you know, all these people who've been changed by the internet eventually become the leaders, and the whole thing just gradually morphs into something else that might look democratic down the road.
To expand this even further, the scope of this even further, mm-hmm. which I know is daunting, but what is it that the world should learn looking mm-hmm. at what's happening in China with the internet? Mm-hmm. We thought that the lesson was going to be, many of us thought the lesson was going to be that, oh, you can route around mm-hmm. censorship and filtering. And in China, that is generally not really the case. So that mm-hmm. that's one thing that we've learned. More broadly, looking at this interplay between a culture that is, much of it is besotted with the internet, and they're doing all the cultural fun things and more free speech, and yet a regime that is unaltered mm-hmm. in its basic freedoms. What is it that the world should learn from looking at this huge experiment?
I think one of the kind of warning signs is that just because a government is putting lots of stuff online and talking to people through the internet doesn't necessarily mean it's more democratic. It might be perhaps it's Bonapartism more than it is real democracy, in that, you know, you have a strong state that's making people feel that they're participating and giving people a feeling of democracy, but actually things aren't more democratic. I think we get sometimes so euphoric about seeing people who are powerful, who used to be closed, suddenly opening up on the internet that we sometimes lose sight of what is the context that we need around that for that to be an actual liberal phenomenon, as opposed to something else that might be quite manipulative and cynical. And I think globally we need to all be thinking about that. And I think China is a really interesting test case for how cynical you can get. Globally, really. I mean, there's this debate going on in China that, you know, between the censors and the people who are pushing back against censorship, the nationalists and the pro-democracy liberals. And, you know, there's a huge debate going on. But, you know, this is somewhat similar. It's akin to debates that are happening globally about, you know, where's the right set point? Where's the right balance between freedom and control on the internet? You know, and the whole debates that happen in the West about, oh, you know, we have to do a better job at controlling the internet and, you know, save our children from these stalkers and fight terrorists and fight identity thieves and so on. And we have to do away with anonymity and, you know, et cetera. We have to filter Australia's web and we have to hold ISPs liable for everything everybody does on the internet, on their networks, because, you know, otherwise bad people might use it to do bad things. Ah, do something. You know, you get a lot of that in the West. and it's an argument that hasn't been resolved. And where do you find the happy medium where civil liberties can be maintained, yet the internet isn't used or abused overly much by bad people to do bad things, and you can still enable good people to do good things, and that this layer of internet and telecoms that really now we've built in between citizens and government as sort of a medium between citizens and government, that doesn't become an opaque arm really of incumbent power, you know, in the West or in the democratic world. And also how to make sure that layer, as it's, of course, extending into authoritarian regimes, isn't just becoming kind of a cynical way in which the government is able to manipulate and spy on people even better, you know. And yeah, certainly people can have their discourse and so on. But, you know, without the institutional legal changes, you know, how far does that take you? So it is really a global debate. It's not just, you know, let's look at China and kind of this weird stuff happening in China. It doesn't relate to anybody else. It actually relates very much to the this global debate we're having about freedom and control and technology. And of course, I think the other thing to keep in mind, too, as we think about, again, there's a lot of discussion about is the current internet broken? Does it need to be re-engineered so that it's more reliable or safer or, you know, whatever? China's very engaged in all these debates. The Chinese government's extremely engaged in all these debates. China is now the country that has more internet users than anybody else. It's whether the Chinese internet is going to have a huge impact on standards and governance going forward. The U.S. still has the greatest impact for and influence for now, but I don't think we can count on that forever. And so how do we engage with this discourse that people in China are having that's similar to the discourse that we're having, and sort of encourage and empower the people who are on the freedom side of things, and try and help make sure that that again this layer doesn't become an opaque arm of incumbent power everywhere.
Do you think there's a single answer to the question control versus freedom, open and closed? This debate that, as you say, is it's global. It's is there a global single answer to it?
I don't think there is. I'd love to know what you think.
I can't imagine that there is. But then the issue is that there is a shared internet here. So.
Yeah, there is a shared internet. Well, it's kind of like, you know, in a democracy, right? We're always fighting about this. So you look at it.
Always will, always have.
And we always will, we always have. And we need to be able to continue to fight about it. And only then can the democracy survive, kind of in a way. And so I think with this global layer, it's probably the same thing. Globally, we're not able quite yet to have a fully robust debate because only people in some countries are really able to engage in that debate fully and others aren't, for political reasons primarily, and also I think perhaps informationally, you know, all kinds of different reasons. But yeah, it's sort of like, you know, just democracy is like a marriage. If you don't work at it constantly, you lose it. And I think it's going to be the same thing with this information layer. People are just going to have to be, you know, if you want to be a citizen rather than a subject, you got to work at maintaining being a citizen and not a subject, and being a netizen and not a, you know, somebody who's acted upon or just a user. If you want rights, you don't just sit back and receive them, right? And so, again, how we take this forward, I don't know. It's just that, you know, no, there's never going to be a magic bullet and it's all going to be solved and we're going to have this wonderful transparent layer between citizens and governments globally and everybody will live happily ever after. Unfortunately not.
Rebecca McKinnon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is David Weinberger for Radio Berkman.
You can follow Rebecca on the web at rconversation.blogs.com. That's the letter R, conversation.blogs.com. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find more programs like this and subscribe to our podcast at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.